Hello and welcome to the Happier at Work podcast. I'm your host, Aoife O'Brien. This is the Career and Culture podcast. And if you are a forward-thinking, people-centric leader, then you're absolutely in the right place. Through a combination of interview-based episodes as well as solo episodes, I share practical tips on creating happier working environments.
Now people are in organizations. How do we access them through mobility programs to have other jobs? How do we create things called talent marketplaces in companies to say, you know, Aoife's done a couple of years in sales. How about if Aoife wants to go and work on product development, or if Aoife wants to go on marketing? And how do we migrate her across the organization based on the skills that she's got? And how do we point her to either development opportunities, learning opportunities, mobility opportunities, so she can get that experience and be qualified for that role? So there's really two components of it. There's how do we bring people in? How do we move people around organizations where we can?
Whether you are looking to strategically and more proactively manage your career or create a more positive work culture in your organization, this is definitely the podcast for you. Hello and welcome to episode 200 of the Happier at Work podcast. I can hardly believe I'm saying those words. What started out as a microphone, an idea, and a SoundCloud account has turned into something quite a lot bigger than I had anticipated or planned for. But I have so enjoyed this journey, the people that I get to connect with, the people I have conversations with, the amount of learning that I do from those conversations that I have, and the obviously the processes and everything behind the podcast, learning all the new technologies, that's something that really lights me up as well. But today is a very special episode. Bhushan Sethi has been on the podcast on episode 50, episode 100, and episode 150, and now he joins me for episode 200. So what started out as kind of a joke has been an ongoing thing. So I was hoping to be in New York to record this in person. I was going to say to record it live. It's, you know, we're going to do a live one. I think this is on my plans for this year. So let me know if you want to attend a live recording of the Happier at Work podcast. But what I would love to do is record it in person in New York. So I'm setting that as my goal for next year for episode 250 to get him back on. And we will do a recording in New York, maybe a live recording, never know. But today's episode, I enjoyed it so much, and I've decided to split it into two parts because we had kind of a separate conversation at the end. So you'll hear the bulk part of our conversation today. And then on Monday, I'll release a bonus episode, which has the additional content that we spoke about as well. So you'll get that on Monday if you're listening in real time. If you're not listening in real time, you'll get it. You'll see it in your podcast feed anyway. But what I always love about my conversations with Bhushan is he so has his finger on the pulse. It's all research based. He's seeing the evolution. He's seeing what's coming down the road in terms of the future of work. So I know you're really, really going to enjoy today's episode. We talk about various things like AI, which prompted my solo episode on AI. So from that conversation we had after we stopped recording, he suggested, would you not think to do an episode on a behind the scenes of AI? So that's what I did. We talk about skills and how there's skills shortages, where those shortages come from, how to close those gaps, but also how to rethink how we hire people and how we work by focusing on those skills. We talk about how hybrid is the future and how to make that work. The importance of being in the office for young people for socialization. If I think back to my early career, that's where I made a lot of my friends, was through work. It's how you learn the ropes, just by being around other people who are doing those same things as you. So the onboarding, the learning, we talk about all of these things. We talk about the challenge with performance reviews. We talk about inclusion. There are so many different topics that we talk about today. And I would love to hear what you thought about today's episode. As always, you can connect with me directly. All of my links are on the website, happieratwork.ie. I most often would post on LinkedIn, so do feel free to reach out and connect with me there as well. And I really hope you enjoy today's special episode 200 of the Happier at Work podcast. Welcome back, Bhushan, to the Happier Work podcast. This is the third time I think we've actually had a live chat, and the fourth time technically that you've been on the Happier Work podcast. What started as a slight joke about getting you on for episode 50, because that was our original conversation, and then a highlight episode 100, and then another conversation for episode 150, and now for another conversation for episode 200. You're so welcome back, and I'm so looking forward to having this conversation with you.
Delighted to be back. We have a great New York morning, but I'm sure we'll brighten that up, and I'm looking forward to this discussion.
I think we kind of touched on some of the topics before we started recording, but I would love to know a little bit more about this, the Skills First report that was done in conjunction with the World Economic Forum. Do you want to maybe talk to us about maybe the reason behind it and some of the highlights from the report?
Yep, sure. We've been working with the World Economic Forum for over a year now on the concept of skills first hiring, and how firms start using skills as a currency, not just to hire people, but also to redeploy them in their organizations. We use terms like skills as a currency, and as opposed to rigid job descriptions and qualifications and experiences that really shorten the labor pools and shorten the number of candidates you could have available based on education, college degree, years of experience, et cetera. So skills-based hiring is basically to say, what skills do I need for a role? If I want to hire for wealth management in a bank, what skills do I need? And it's not necessary that that person needs to have got that experience in banking. They could have got really good client relationship skills by working in sales in a different industry. They could learn finance through certifications as opposed to, say, accounting degrees. And so really looking at how do we broaden access to labor pools and therefore bring in people that have more diverse characteristics, diverse socioeconomic backgrounds, which is really important around the world and especially in the US where I live, and also kind of diverse from other areas, maybe women who have kind of taken time out to raise kids, people from marginalized communities, refugees, etc. So the concept is, how do we broaden access to labor? How do we, because we do have labor and skills shortages around the world still, how do we make sure that we're creating opportunity and access for people from different backgrounds? And in doing that, how do we make organizations more agile in the world of AI, more green jobs, more people needing to reskill as more and more jobs get digitized? And I'm sure we'll talk about that. How do you actually bring people in and build those skills on the job? So that's the concept. We're very proud of the report. We've got lots of great examples of companies in there that are doing bits around skills-based hiring. And then the other piece around this is there's a skills-based organization revolution that's really starting around corporations. And that's really talking about now people are in organizations, how do we access them through mobility programs to have other jobs? How do we create things called talent marketplaces in companies to say, you know, Aoife's done a couple of years in sales. How about if Aoife wants to go and work on product development, or if Aoife wants to go on marketing? And how do we migrate her across the organization based on the skills that she's got? And how do we point her to either development opportunities, learning opportunities, mobility opportunities, so she can get that experience and be qualified for that role? So there's really two components of it. There's how do we bring people in? And then when people are in, how do we move people around organizations where we can?
Yeah, I love that. Any thoughts on some of the blockers that might stop people from kind of using this type of skills first approach?
Yeah. Well, firstly, I think it's important to say that skills first doesn't replace deep specialist skills. If we want to ride the airplane, we still need pilots. We still need pilots that have certain years of experience and certain kind of, you know, obviously credentials. The most specialist heart surgeons are still going to have gone to med school and got you know, the requisite training. Legal authorities around the world are still going to want lawyers to be qualified based off of their education and their legal requirements. So it doesn't replace all of those deep specialists. But some of the resistance we get from organizations are going to be the classic manager who wants to hire people in their own image. People that have gone to certain schools, people that feel that there's a traditional route into banking or technology or blue chip organizations. And so it's really taking a leap of faith on the side of leaders who have maybe grown up in a different way to say non-traditional backgrounds are okay. People that have potential and adjacent skills are okay. It's incumbent on us to create the onboarding and the training and development opportunities. And even not every one of them, those hires is going to work out, but it's all about how do we give people opportunity? How do we access more people in the labor force? As we've talked about in the past, demographics are not on our side. We have population decline in a number of the parts of the developed world. We still have an abundance of jobs. And with AI, there's potentially new industries that are created that we haven't even thought about, new business models, and there'll be new skills and jobs required. So it's incumbent on all of us in our roles in business, in education, in parenting, to take a leap of faith in this area. But yeah, there will be some traditional blockers, as you say.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting. You brought up this concept a couple of times of labor shortages and skills shortages. Now, do you want to explain that for someone who's a little bit, I'm trying to find the right words now for this, but who maybe doesn't fully understand, like, I don't understand how is there labor shortages? Like, I don't understand. Why can't we just teach people the skills that they need to do the jobs? Like, can you explain a little bit more about how that came about and what we can do about it and what it really means?
And it might feel like an oxymoron when we see headlines of firms making layoffs as well. I mean, here in the US, we have unemployment that's still lower than 4%. So you could say that in the US, we have a fully employed America. However, you still see headlines around layoffs in the tech sector because of overhiring. You see it in financial services. Yeah. But that is a small percentage of the overall workforce. When we talk to clients in labor-intensive industries, think about coffee shops, think about retail stores, think about truckers and delivery folks. There's still a shortage of people willing to do that kind of work. And why? Because there is still an ability to do lots of kinds of work in a more flexible way from home. And so we have labor shortages in terms of in the number of open positions economically versus the number of people seeking employment is always skews higher to the number of open positions. So again, it might feel counterintuitive to the data that you read in the headlines, but that's the labor shortages piece. But the real damaging risk for society is we have labor shortages, but we also have skills mismatches. And that's where the skills-based hiring gets in. So as we automate more work in a manufacturing environment, as we automate more work in a contact center environment, when you're making those calls to your airline or your HR call center, there's going to be displacements of those people, and those people are going to have to reskill to do other work. And that work is typically going to involve some form of technology, whether it's Gen AI, other parts of AI, basic automation, climate technology. They're going to have to learn new skills. So we haven't got enough people in the labor force, and jobs are going to be impacted, especially by AI. And therefore, we need to kind of figure out that skills mismatch to say, the people that have been doing very labor intensive roles that haven't used computers and are not knowledge workers. We have to figure out, whether it's business, whether it's academia, whether it's government, or all three, how we can actually help them with the reskilling that they need. So we have a more employed society, and we have kind of the ability to get everyone to participate, and it doesn't put a drain on the state and doesn't drive kind of civil unrest and frankly, increase income inequality, which is rising again in much of the world, especially here in the US.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit more about this idea of skills matching. And are there any technologies, I know of some that exist, but maybe in kind of small pockets, but that can facilitate that type of thing. So understanding what someone's, whether it's their innate abilities, the strengths that they have, like, talk to me a little bit more about what that is and how that might work in reality.
Yeah, most of the major HR technology vendors that big firms will be using have these modules where you can actually go in and assess your skills, understand kind of what skill requirements there are for the job. Some organizations have invested in building their own or leveraging this concept of a talent marketplace, where you would see open jobs very much like you would see on an external site, and you'd say what skill requirements are there. The challenge in organizations with that is just maintaining the data. There's so many organizations that have those skills modules of those HR systems and have said, we're not fully using it because we're not asking people to go and do a skills assessment and update it kind of every year. Organizations do that in times when they have to. So I work with a lot of financial institutions that have had regulatory requirements that said, we want to understand your risk and compliance teams and your business teams and what skills they have, because we think they're systemic risks, or we think that's the root cause of some of your issues. So people do it out of forced external necessity. But people are loath to kind of go in and maintain kind of all of that data.
Yeah, yeah. Because does it rely kind of on the individual to input that, or to take an assessment to measure their level of skill? And they're like, I've enough to do in my day job. Why do I want to do this, you know, without the bigger picture thinking of this could actually help my career and help me to be happier at work at the end of the day?
Yes, absolutely. It's a real commitment on behalf of organizations to be all in around, you need to maintain these. We're going to use these in deployment. We're going to use this in hiring. Some people, we're going to link it to our learning plans, and we're going to invest in your learning, and you could maybe even get external credentials around some of these technical or human skills. But as you'll see in the report, there are organizations that are leading the charge on this and have done different aspects of what I'm describing. So it's not all doom and gloom. I think there's a lot that can be learned from the report.
Brilliant. I love that. One of the other things that struck me, and you have mentioned it earlier, is this idea of removing the necessity for having a degree. Like that, if I go back 25 years, or, you know, show my age here now, but go back 20 something years to when I came out of college, and it was pretty much a prerequisite for any sort of knowledge working job that you were looking for at that time. You had to have a degree. In a lot of cases, people are looking for masters, and I see requirements for MBAs for jobs that are, in my opinion, maybe not that senior. How are we going to shift our mindset around this requirement, especially given that the people in quite senior roles now would have had that requirement when they were entering the labor force?
So in PwC UK, they've got a program and they've removed degree requirements. I know some other accounting firms have in the UK as well. We're going to get there by just more success stories. To say, we're not saying that people shouldn't go to college, but what we are saying is there's a lot of people that don't go to further education today. In the US, it's very expensive for people to actually go into certain universities, and the cost of higher education at the top level is growing.
Yeah,
and so
and they're still
if you
paying
don't have
for
that
it, you know, 20 years later.
Absolutely, rising student debt. So we all see the headlines, and so what we're saying is we just need more success stories, and those people that either don't have the opportunity or don't see the need and want to get into the workforce for whatever reasons, that there needs to be opportunities. But we're still going to have, I teach at NYU, so we're still going to have advanced degrees. We're still going to have people that want to, part of going to college is learning, but it's also learning about yourself, as you know.
And learning how to learn and learning how to disseminate information and consolidate information. One of the things that kind of came up when I was doing my master's is the kind of the future of academia and how maybe it's not bundled into a degree as such, but you pick various different modules that will support you on what it is that you aspire to become. So you kind of almost build your own course and it adds up to X number of credits, but that it's not kind of a fixed, like you have to do all of these different things, but it becomes very much choosing different credited subjects to kind of build your own, essentially.
Yeah, and we see that in organizations where I think what you're describing is you curate your own learning path. We're seeing that a lot with AI, where companies are coming to us to say, how do we actually teach people about Gen AI so they can apply it to their jobs and think about these things that are called use cases, and how we actually help them free up time and use use the Gen AI so that they have access to knowledge so they can actually be faster in their roles, whether they're in finance, whether they're in legal, whether they're in accounting, learning about digital, learning about data, learning about regulation, understanding the business process. There's a lot of curated learning you're going to have to apply. It's not just learning the technical skills.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe let's talk about that. What are some of the digital skills that are required? How do people take that first step towards becoming aware of what it is that they need to do?
Yeah, so we're seeing that. We were talking about kind of how you curate learning. Mm-hmm. And in the Gen AI environment, where people are understanding, how do I access these large language models that have different training data? How do I actually create, it's called prompt engineering. How do I actually create prompts to say, you know, how do I solicit large amounts of information on case law or on accounting policy or on, you know, how to kind of look at credit policy for my customers? How do I access that information and kind of be more efficient? So to learn Gen AI and apply it to jobs, you have to really understand business processes. You have to understand the customer outcomes you're trying to drive. You're going to have to understand how to build the right use cases and prompt engineering. And so it uses a lot of skills around digital and data analytics and business skills and experimentation and agility and measuring outcomes. So back to the point around learning, we're seeing it even in the Gen AI revolution. It's not all about learning the technical aspects. It's about learning kind of the holistic business aspects, which again, just goes back to the point that we all need to be lifelong learners.
Yes.
We're all learning through Gen AI today. Technology is going to rapidly change in the next few years, and we're all going to have to continue that learning agility and apply it to different businesses, different business models, etc.
So rather than thinking AI is here to take my job, which I think is kind of the doom and gloom headlines that you might see or that people might think or that people might feel, it's understanding the wider holistic business. What customer outcomes am I trying to achieve here? How can I use AI to support me in the role that I do? And you've shared some examples there that I had never really thought about. But if you have to wade through tons and tons of information to find what it is that you need, you can actually use AI to support you with that, given that you're inputting the right things based on what it is that you're trying to get to. So again, this idea of prompt engineering and knowing what it is that you're looking for in the first place and being able to express that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not gonna take your job, but the important thing to understand about AI is it's gonna augment roles. So the best accountants, the best lawyers, the best creative film directors can use AI, can use Gen AI to really supercharge their productivity and create faster, create kind of using more data sets, etc. So some of the best people in those professions where they can augment will be supercharged and super successful, and you potentially need less of them because they can be more productive. And so there are going to be some people in accounting and finance and call centers that do get displaced, and therefore they have to reskill to other roles that either AI creates or the green economy creates or new business models create, you know, or they've got to kind of reskill into other areas. And so that's the tricky transition that businesses, governments, and frankly, us as individuals are going to have, that there are going to be a whole bunch of people that get supercharged and become kind of the elite of people, how to use it, and it actually improves their job. There's going to be some knowledge workers that are impacted because we're going to need less people in the call center, and we're going to need less people in finance and law and accounting. And then what we also need to remember is, less so in the US, but in economies like India, where there's 40 to 60% of people that are in jobs where they're not part of the digital economy. They're in agriculture. They're in labor intensive industries. They're in trucking, they're in transportation. You know, what is it that we do for them? Because how do they actually get the digital skills? If our belief is more and more work will become digitized, how do we get the people that don't have digital skills today? And we call this the digital divide. How do we make sure that divide does not get bigger? And so that's the That's the big conundrum. And there's a really good piece of analysis from the IMF that was published, which we can include in the show notes, which I really encourage people to read. It's some of the best analysis. It goes through different countries and what proportion of their economy is services industries and knowledge work type industries versus labor intensive. And how, if you're a labor intensive industry and you don't get to participate in the digital revolution, your GDP can actually go down. And you could actually get a bigger disparity between, say, developed countries and developing. So it's some really fascinating piece of analysis.
No, definitely we'll include that in the show notes as well. Bhushan, you mentioned a couple of times this idea of the green economy. I presume that's something to do with climate change. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that? And it comes up in the report as well.
Yeah. If we look to the future, and let's take a leap of faith that climate change is real. Firms are going to have to redesign their business models and their supply chains and reduce their carbon footprint. And we cannot be so reliant on fossil fuels. What that means is different businesses are going to have to kind of reinvent how they source production, how they look at sources of energy, how they access minerals in the world, how they think about their own carbon footprint and emissions. And that's going to create a whole abundance of new jobs, from deep technical jobs, a lot of technology type jobs to say, how do we think about climate technology? How do we think about heating? How do we think about power sources? How do we think about how we report on all of these things? And this is where also AI and climate EPA come together, because if you think about the energy that you need for all of these large language models and Gen AI, it is huge. And there is not enough computing power on the earth today for us to fuel all of the Gen AI we need. So companies are going to have to look at their AI strategy and their ESG or sustainability strategy and their carbon emissions data that they want to kind of share and disclose together so that they can actually answer those questions. So that's where these come together. So there's going to be new skills that people need, and new jobs and roles that get created in organizations, and new industries that grow up around climate and sustainability, and around technology, you know, notably, Gen AI right now.
Yeah. Something else that has come up in the report, and we've spoken about it on the podcast before, but this idea of networking and using your network for career advancement, and that being one of the big challenges, that's often how, and again, you touched on it earlier, where you're saying you're recruiting people from very specific schools, for example, and we need to stop with that practice. But how do we stop with that? Like, from my perspective, like, maybe that works quite well. I can understand how it creates a divide. But if people are thinking, well, it ain't broke, it's actually working quite well at the moment, then how do we shift away from those kind of practices?
Yeah, so there's something in the report from one of our PwC Global Workforce Surveys that talks about, people in your network. Do you have access to people in your network? We also look at things like, do you have skills that are underrepresented on your resume, et cetera. The conundrum with the relationships part of the networks is, what we always kind of encourage people to do in business is build good relationships. You know, even when you leave a company, there's a way to leave a company. You've got to kind of maintain relationships with, you know, your colleagues, to some extent, you know, your customers, your suppliers, etc. Because relationships matter and networks matter. And especially when you're in the market to look for new employment, or even frankly, new business. The challenge is that networks need to be diverse. It cannot just be around a certain socioeconomic, or it cannot just be people who live in a certain part of London or Europe or Bombay or New York. And so the recommendation is that we all need to continue to invest in relationships. We all need to leverage networks, whether we're in the market, whether we're looking for mentors, whether we're looking for coaches. But we've got to really look at the diversity of those networks, and are we, back to the skills-based hiring, are we actually giving equal opportunity to other people to form our networks? There are many, many times when I get reached out to people, even outside my organization, just for a conversation, because they know people who know me. And at this stage of my life, like, I say yes to some of those things because I think it's important to give people an access. And I also choose that in some of the things that I do in terms of where I speak and where I write and kind of what podcast, because I think it's important to make sure that we're not just hanging around with the same people in what we call our echo chambers. And people who finish your sentences. We need to be accessing younger people, people from different walks of life, different, you know, backgrounds, religions, ages, etc.
Yeah, people who challenge how you think, people who challenge how you perceive the world, because how you perceive the world is a function of how you were brought up, where you went to school, who you're friends with, everything that you've learned up to now, the companies that you've worked in, all of those kinds of things. So it's very good that you're doing that. And that's how we connected in the first place. I think you throwing back a few years, but you commented on something on someone else's post. We connected on LinkedIn. We had a conversation. I invited you to be on the podcast. And, you know, it just shows the power of that connection. But for people to bear in mind that you need to diversify those networks as well, so give back and put your hand down to help people who are kind of younger or earlier stage career than you are, and broaden your networks to people maybe who are retired as well, to get, you know, different ways of thinking. Is there anything else that you wanted to share specifically in relation to the report that we haven't covered?
Not necessarily on the report, but just on this relationships point, Aoife.
Yeah,
social media gets a bad rep because disinformation, we spend too much time on it. But this is where social media can actually help, because you can actually manage your brand and your profile and whether it's LinkedIn or other social media, that's where people can actually form those connections and get to know each other and show good grace and comment on something or ask questions. And so, you know, that's something I would also encourage people, that, you know, it's a broad world out there. We can actually build relationships online with people who are very different to us. Mm. And whether you're at a stage in your life or your career where you're giving back and giving advice and mentoring, or if you're new to the workplace and you're looking to learn and connect, there's so many ways that we can use it to add our mutual benefit.
Tune in on Monday to hear the rest of this conversation.